What's going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Conspiracy or Just a Coincidence. I am Jack Allen. Happy Memorial Day. Hope you're doing well, and hopefully you got to hang out with your family today or tomorrow or whenever you listen to this. First, go follow me at Kojak Podcast on Twitter and Instagram, and I put all the links in the show notes. So if you want to check out the show or support the show, all those things, all that stuff's there. So today's show was awesome. Oh my God. He was great. His name's Counterpoints, and you can go subscribe to him on YouTube. I'll put his link in the show notes. Super articulate guy, very intelligent. We definitely are coming from different ends of the political spectrum, or maybe just like ideas about why things go so wrong. Mine, obviously, we're a conspiracy show. So I think it's planned and organized and pieces are moved on the chessboard. Whereas I think Counterpoints, his view is more, it can be explained, you know, whether it's human error, whatever reason. And he's so really well-informed guy. I love the show. I thought it was really interesting, really informative. We're in this hyper polarizing, angry, whatever political climate. And you can't ever hear another person's idea. That's so broken. Dude, it's so broken. And we would do a lot better as a society if we heard the other side out. So I thought he brought up a lot of great points, and it made me reassess a few things. Though, do I still think, we talk about 9/11, do I still think 9/11 was planned? 100%. But it was interesting, his viewpoints, and he's super well-read guy. He was in the military, cop, traveled way more than I've ever will, and has seen more of the world than I will ever see. But it was really good. Brian in the chat, if you are always on the live stream, Brian, he's an OG there. He said it was one of his favorite shows. So thank you, Brian. Thanks for listening, guys. Go follow Counterpoint. He's got, I think, 23,000 subscribers on YouTube. Add him a few more. He definitely is an intelligent guy. I wouldn't recommend anybody that wasn't, up to snuff, and he definitely is. So go check him out. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a wonderful weekend. I'm Jack Allen with Conspiracy or Just a Coincidence, and we'll talk soon. God bless. Peace. All right, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Conspiracy or Just a Coincidence. I am Jack Allen. First, happy Memorial Day, and this episode works out perfect. It's like fate brought us together. I have I guess there is no ex-Marine, right? A former Marine or a Marine veteran. Counterpoints, aka Connor. So Counterpoints, thanks for coming on the show, dude, and thank you for your service as well.
My sincere pleasure and displeasure. My pleasure was, you know, the parts of the service I enjoyed, displeasure being my current back pain. You might see me grab like a Theracane and massage out my shoulders randomly throughout the show. That's that's the displeasure of service.
But all right, so now I'm aware.
Very happy to be here.
I'm aware. All right, well, so I mean, right, like I told you I saw you on the Killstream versus Nick Fuentes, and I think he's obviously very pro Russia. And I was really interested because of your background, you were a police. Or I guess first tell everyone like a little bit about yourself, and then we'll get into that.
Yeah. So I, not to go too far back in the lore, but I was born in Boston, raised in Florida, moved to Belgium, moved to Texas, moved to Florida, joined the military. And then went to Japan, Iraq from Japan, then California. Then after that, I got out, got my 4-year degree. And then after I got my 4-year degree, I became a city cop for 4 years. Jeez. So I've kind of seen the spectrum of violence, and I moved every 3 years since I was like 8 years old. So I like to think that I've seen a good chunk of the world, and I know that I'm wrong about a lot of shit, but like, I know that I'm less wrong than a lot of other people. So that, and then I'm like Irish, so temperamentally I like to fight people by nature. So I saw people on the internet who were fighting for money, and I was like, I like fighting for fun, so maybe I can get online and fight people for money and fun. And then now 23,000 subscribers later, here we are. So we're,
dude,
you know,
that's,
we're doing
awesome.
Good, we're having fun.
No, so that's what, like, your viewpoint, I didn't know all that travel, obviously, but I thought that's a much better perspective than a lot of people that fight on the internet. And so I want your take on the Ukraine. I'm kind of like ambivalent. I don't have like a real opinion. I think they're all created wars, but we can get into it. But what's your take on what's going on there and all the madness that is occurring?
Well, I think from a descriptive perspective, we might find more in common than you believe. Like, so for instance, like, I think that the United States is at the head of a $65 trillion commercial empire, that we are interested in foreign nations, maybe at times for democracy and humanitarian reasons, but that's always going to take a backseat to material interest. So whether you're talking about like oil or rare earth minerals or military trade or something like that, then that's our reason for being over there. But that's kind of like the first level of analysis. And then the second level of analysis is this good or is this bad? We know this kills tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people every year. We know that a lot of people don't like it. We know that a lot of people don't like the American empire or the capitalist commercial international empire. We know that, but then we also get to reap the benefits. You and I, every product in our home is probably covered in some level of plastic. We're operating on very cheap manufactured goods that are created by globalism. And so where I kind of landed is I want to look at the horrors that the Western world inflicts on the rest of the world, honestly, and I want to be honest about our sins in the name of global commercial empire. But then I also want to compare it to the alternatives, which I view as like isolationism or, you know, kind of us going our own way, or our peer competitors taking, you know, seize the mantle of like global power. And when I look at our competitors, I don't think that they would do a better job than we do. And as a matter of fact, they might have some more nefarious consequences than even we do. And we have some pretty nefarious consequences. I'll wrap it up, but that's the approach that I took into the Nick Fuentes conversation, because I've always been trying to understand the Groypers. I've always been trying to understand the Nick Fuentes crowd, and I was actually really happy just to have like what I hope is an earnest conversation. I hope if people go back and look at that, I hope Nick was being honest with me, because I felt like I was just trying to be inquisitive and understand his worldview and also tell him I understand his worldview, but have you considered the alternative? And that was kind of the conversation we had.
Right. No. So I think you bring it. I really like what you said. I think you're right. We agree on the American empire is evil in most cases. But so you said that you would be concerned that like another country would take over America's role. So could you like elaborate on that more? Like your fear would be like a China or something could come in, or just elaborate, I guess.
Yeah, so if you actually look at like WEF or NATO aligned or Western aligned countries, either on like a unilateral or multilateral basis, the world economy, I want to say, is like between $80 and $90 trillion. And all of the countries that are basically aligned with the commercial empire, it makes up about like 65 trillion of the 90 trillion. So this is kind of like, regardless of whether or not you're talking about like Vietnam or Chile or some shit like that, we basically, the American commercial empire has $65 trillion of the global economy under its control, whereas there's about $20 to $30 trillion that is with exact antagonists. So whether that's China, Russia, Venezuela, Iran, and you'll notice these antagonists because literally American public media will try to gin up American resentment of these people. Hmm. And so for me, like, I don't think we're necessarily going to go to war with these countries, but I think that they're trying to prepare the American mindset for diplomatic, economic, and actual warfare against these countries. That way, if it happens, we can say, oh, our good buddies Saudi Arabia are helping us fight the evil Iranian monsters. And like, if you look at the history of these two countries, any moral indictment you could make of the Iranians, you could equally make of the Saudis, but they're not on our team. So as a result, screw them, and they won't bend the knee to American empire, which is why they're antagonists, which is why we're always going to go after them. And so that can be a little conspiracy minded, but I think it's accurate.
Well, so this is my take that all like, have you ever heard of the guy, Anthony Sutton? He was a professor. He was like a big conspiracy author, old guy, like 70s, but he wrote a lot of these three, like a series. It was how Wall Street funded Hitler, Wall Street funded the Bolsheviks, and I forget the third one, but basically it was the point that, you know, the Soviet Union would never have existed if it weren't for Harrimans and Rockefellers and all of Wall Street funding them. And so that's like put me into this and whether it's right or wrong, is that all these countries, there are no real adversaries. They're controlled by these bankers at the top, and it's just like a WWE fight to get us, you know, just like with Russia or whatever. It's just like a rah-rah bread and circus routine. Do you have any, what's your take on like that kind of theory?
So for me, I think you have to push past that a little bit just for like the actual real world moral consequences of these decisions. So for instance, like I agree with you. And actually, if you look at American politics, you can kind of see this as well. Bankers and corporations will fund the Democrat Party and they'll fund the Republican Party simultaneously because they want to have inroads into both avenues of power. Mm-hmm. I think that if you asked the Rockefellers at the 1940s, maybe they would say, hey, this is like a secret plot. We're going to make the whole world communist. Oh, we're going to seize all the power. Maybe they would say that. Or yeah. Maybe they would say, hey, Russia is rich in this, and this material. We want to gain access to it. So as a result, we see this new, like there's a political faction that's less receptive to our interest. There's a political faction that's more receptive to our interest. So we're actually going to fund the interest that's more friendly to us in order to try to cause a revolution. And then we'll gain material footholds into this thing. And so you can say that's evil because, I mean, this will result in the deaths of tens of thousands, yeah. if not hundreds of thousands of people. You're putting material profit before human lives and your own morality. So there's absolutely, like, I don't ignore the disgusting things we've done in the name of materialism. But then we look at the lives of people in these regimes, like versus the competitive regimes. And there are real moral consequences to whether or not there's mixed economy capitalism, whether or not there's democracy, whether or not there's republics, whether or not there's voting, whether or not there's theocracy, whether or not there's authoritarian communism. So I think you're right about the bankers funding everything, but then I don't necessarily ascribe like a very specific agenda. I think they're kind of motivated the same way we all are.
Mm. So like I feel, and I like how you said that they're an evil communist plot, but they seem to like fund these groups that they want to, you know, remove the free market, have this monopoly, I think the phrase is corporate socialist, where they're at the top, as opposed to a true socialist where the government's at the top, the private enterprise or the monopolies are the ones that are actually pulling all the strings. So you do not like believe that that's happening, or that's one of their goals, or these huge, like an Amazon or Jeff Bezos or whatever.
I would have to talk to them. There's obviously like such a thing as like a corporate capture, I think they call, or what do they call it? It's like bureaucratic capture. It's where corporations will literally fund public officials in order to get into regulatory agencies that are a part of the state in order to be able to create regulations that affect their competitors but yes. don't affect them.
Right.
And so I think it's called regulatory capture, actually.
Okay.
And so if I was to sit in a room with these people and I'm like, hey, why are you funding the communist regime? I would be as unsurprised if they were like, hey, I'm actually rubbing my fingers together because I'm a Bond villain. Or if they were like, hey, they got some access to like some rubber mine and this random bureaucrat in this city told me to fuck off. So I'm funding his rival in order to fuck him over. I would be equally opportune for both answers, but I don't know. And also the thing that I've come up in as I've come up in institutions, the reason why I don't think 9/11 is an inside job or a conspiracy is because people can't shut the fuck up about anything. like enlisted people. I was literally seeing, like, I'm watching like secret documents, like classified secret on my email, like casualty statistics for the war in Iraq during like 07, 08. And then I'm watching like the same shit on CNN like 2 days later. You know what I'm saying? Like people can't, like, especially in the American empire, we can't shut the fuck up about what we do. Literally, our veterans get on TV and they're like, this is how you garrote somebody with piano wire. You know, like it. So getting a few thousand people to shut the fuck up about like 9/11 or some shit, I don't put a lot of credence in that.
Interesting. So you're clearly an articulate guy, well-read guy. So you believe the story that whatever the media tells us for 9/11.
So it depends on what you mean. Some of this stuff is public record, some of it isn't. Usama bin Laden is only, he's one of 54 children. So
damn, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so he's one of 54 kids, and his mother. So if I remember the story correctly, the House of Saud gains power through like Western backing in like the early 1910s, 1920s. It might have been like the late 1800s, but who gives a shit? Yeah. They appoint a construction group to take care of Mecca, and that's the Bin Laden family. And so the Bin Laden family is actually the Saudi equivalent to the Trump family in the United States of America. Mm. If you say Trump and you think like construction and real estate and all that kind of stuff, that's what Bin Laden was prior to 9/11. That's what that name meant.
Okay.
And so he's one of 54 kids, but his mother only has one kid, gets neglected by the dad. I think it's either his grandpa or his father dies in like a single plane accident because he flew into some electricity wires because he was like, I'm a billionaire magnate with like 50 fucking wives. I don't give a shit what I'm doing. And he literally flies into some electrical wires, which is so fucking stupid that I don't like. It's so stupid. I believe it. Yeah. So he's ignored, neglected. So he's a part of an ultra connected family in an ultra connected part of the world. But he is a social reject. He is rejected by his father. He is rejected by the Saudi family, all that kind of stuff. So to make a name for himself, using the Bin Laden name, he goes to Afghanistan and fundraises for the Mujahideen during the 1980s. I don't think he, at least according to most of the stuff that I've researched, he doesn't have direct contact with the CIA. He's just a popularized figure at that time for what he did. The CIA was working with a group called the Haqqani Network at that time, which was actually a rival to Bin Laden's power. So it was actually like a different group.
Okay.
And so Bin Laden, during 1989, he sees the, sorry if I keep ranting, but this is like,
you're not, you're telling me new stuff. I love it, dude. Continue ranting.
Awesome. Then this is all incredibly important because the reality is almost more interesting than the conspiracy theory that you could invent. I want to say it was 1982, the United States backs the Israeli army as they're in Lebanon. And one of the things that happens is the Israeli army shoots flares up into the sky while a Christian militia in Lebanon massacres 3,000 Muslim civilians within a town. And so like the Israelis deny complicity because they're like, oh, we thought they were just sweeping and clearing. We didn't know that they were actually just murdering men, women and children. So there's some plausible deniability. And then the United States says, hey, we were just trying to get the Israelis out of there. It's not our responsibility. But the way Bin Laden reads it is you have Jews defying like Muslim political hegemony in the Middle East and North Africa, which is not acceptable from his worldview. You have Christians who are assisting and who are now the preeminent military power who are doing that. This is a complete reversal of the world order from like a Muslim theocratic jihadist perspective. And then in 1989, when Saddam Hussein invades or 1990, I guess, when he invades Kuwait, instead of calling on the Mujahideen, who have just proven themselves against the Russian military, Saudi Arabia calls on the United States. And from their perspective, that's like inviting heretics and disbelievers and scumbags into your country to protect. Why are you so weak that you have to invite disbelievers into your country? And even if you are, it would be better to be loyal to God and basically fight using the Mujahideen than it would be to call in these disbelieving, secular, great Satan assholes who helped massacre Muslims in Lebanon. So he cites this in his 9/11 thing. He's like, my goal is to bait the United States into a war in the Middle East on conventional grounds so the Muslim population sees how fucking evil they are, rises up, we create a new theocratic empire, and we kick Westerners out of our realm. That's literally his stated agenda. And so he gets what he wants. And we fucking, after 9/11, we fall for the bait. We go into the country, we kill hundreds of thousands of people. We basically have a terrible war costing trillions of dollars and almost like a million human lives. And the Ummah, the body of Muslims, was not activated the way Osama bin Laden thought they were going to be, but he did achieve his stated goals in a lot of respects. And so that's kind of where, for me, him being on like liver medication or hiding out in like some fucking secret cave with the CIA, to me, reality is actually, or what seems to be reality is more explanatory than what I can invent.
So like, and how do you disprove, like, you know, I mean, I'm not trying to like the things they always say, like the passports and this, but bigger ones like Donald Rumsfeld coming out that they lost, you know, the $3.2 trillion the day before, like all these things. Do you think that these are just inept, like people that just are people make inept mistakes?
I don't know. What I will tell you is, so for instance, there's this book called The Art of Intelligence by Henry Crumpton. And literally he describes a meeting with Donald Rumsfeld in 2001. And he literally says, we walk in and we say, Al-Qaeda is real. After the USS Cole bombing, they're getting more serious. They're trying to launch a more serious, sophisticated attack on United States soil. And Donald Rumsfeld literally tells the analysts, come back to me when you can tie this to Iraq. Okay. This is before 9/11. And so if you were looking at the history, since 1991, we had Iraq on like a sanctioned lockdown, mm-hmm. where we basically, like, we weren't at war anymore, but we were still flying combat air patrols over their airspace saying that they can't bomb their own civilians. And we had like basically frozen them out economically from the world. So Iraq was still at war with us. We were just so powerful, we weren't at war with them.
Wow.
And so if you ask me what happened, I think Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney talked to each other and they said, hey, we can't invade Iraq in 1991 because we don't have enough popular will. But in order to incorporate Iraq into this global world order, we're going to have a long-term strategy. Let's go work with some private corporations for nation building. And if you look at KBR and Halliburton, really what they did for the past 20 or 30 years is they started doing nation building in like Africa and shit. And they started doing governmental consultative work. And so when Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld both come back into power, for me, it's like it's two birds and one stone for them. They might have a moral argument for why they want to see Saddam Hussein out of power, but realistically, they want to make their billionaire friends fucking rich at the same time. So by killing Saddam, going to war in Iraq, toppling him, and getting KBR and Halliburton to have like no bid contracts, they get rich and they get to implement their version of American hegemony on the world, and their friends get rich. And they cement their legacy as neoconservative, whatever the fucking monstrous shit that they are. So yeah. Anyway, sorry. I'm talking a lot, but the shit's complicated.
No, dude, you're doing an amazing. Your recall is very impressive, very impressive. But so, like, I fall under this camp, and of all these wars are always just started by a false flag. You have like, obviously 9/11.
Tonkin.
You have Vietnam. What was the Gulf of Tonkin. In World War One, the Lusitania that were passenger ships, but there was actually artillery on there. And in my mind, it seems that these things are all just carefully selected maneuvers to change public opinion and to get us to say, yeah, let's go kill these people that we have no idea who they are. What do you see that, like these false flag or whatever you want to call them?
I agree with you, but I think that this is like a shallow reading of history, diplomacy, and warfare. Clausewitz, for instance, his famous saying that I say all the time is, war is diplomacy by other means. And so while you or the average 19-year-old American who's going to fight in these wars doesn't know shit about Iraq or Germany in 1910 or whatever, your bosses do. And they have interests in those countries and they want to implement their agenda. And if they can do it through diplomacy, they're going to. But if they're going to do it through armed conflict, they're going to as well. And so that's where, for me, power abhors a vacuum. The reason why I'm not a libertarian anymore or not an anarcho-capitalist is because like Afghanistan is actually the perfect example. When we were funding the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, the Russians pull out. It doesn't become an independent actor in its own self-interest. What happens is you have five different factions all vying for power that are being paid off by regional powers. So you have like the Pakistanis on one side, the secular Pakistanis and the theocratic Pakistanis on two different sides that are fighting each other. You have like Oman and Iran and Saudi Arabia all funding different militias. So the world in which there is an outside influence in our current era doesn't exist. So the question is, whose influence is it going to be? What impact is it going to have? And what's like the long-term ramifications of that? And again, you asked me about the $3 trillion. I don't know. I would have to do a, do like a forensic accounting look at the DOD spending. You know what probably happened is fucking Reagan literally built like fucking space lasers this that didn't true. Work. And they were like, listen, we don't want to admit that the Star Wars program didn't go anywhere. So we like put a bunch of like $10,000 toilet seats on our accounting books. Don't ask too many questions. Okay. Like we were trying to build space lasers. It was cool. It didn't work. Sorry for the $3 trillion fuck up. So
well, so, and then how would I see, I'm really, you are so well read, I think probably even better than, definitely better than me. So I really value your opinion here. But so all these events, like, I already mentioned the trillions. I'm trying to think of, like how these, elite or these super rich guys, they make these correct stock moves. Like I think the example was Warren Buffett a day before 9/11, everyone shorted airline stocks, or before I think COVID hit, he shorted like MGM and all these casinos and stuff, and he never touched casinos. Like, do you think that these are just happy coincidences, or maybe these people have a little idea something's coming?
Again, I'd have to ask. So for instance, like correlative, like I like the conspiracy or just a coincidence. the reason why I like that is because if you ask me, I don't know. That's oftentimes going to be my answer. Because for instance, some of this intel is out there. It's like floating in the ether. It's public. It's private. It's hybrid. I guarantee you that Buffett probably in order to employ his billions the way that he does, he probably has like his version of an intel agency that tracks different affairs. So basically, like, did he know that Osama bin Laden was specifically going to attack the World Trade Center and then he just made some good moves? Or did he hear from a fucking like a CIA guy that was on his payroll for his intel agency? Hey, we have increased chatter for like terrorist attacks within the next 2 weeks. The executive administration isn't doing anything about it. We think that we're going to take a hit in these sectors, but nobody's listening to me. If you can make money off of me, then go ahead. And like, I don't fucking know. If you wanted a direct answer from me, I would have to become like a forensic accountant.
Yeah.
And then I would expect to die within like 3 months of my research. Like, I think I would absolutely get hit with a heart attack gun, like fucking toot sweet. And it's not because it's like, you know, the Jews specifically or the lizard people specifically, but because rich people want to protect their interest and they don't want to pretend that they're profiting off of human misery, which I'm sure plenty of them are. And we know they are.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I hate when people know all the answers, dude, because very rarely do we have any of the answers. But that's a very interesting viewpoint on, because I just am in this belief, and it could be like a childish or immature belief, but like that the CIA and these super wealthy people, they could topple any country, and they do it systematically oftentimes because of a lack of a central bank or a resource, like you said. And that's my belief that, and the where you said like about not someone would talk, I think things are so, and you might be able to answer this too, that if they're so compartmentalized that these people, they just, I mean, we all have a job. Like I work a real job. I would never, if something was like, you know, that's small in my mind on the moral skew, I could be like, oh, all right. Like I gotta work, dude. I can't, what am I going to do? So you think
some
really
of these people are believers. I think some of them believe in the project. So for instance, like, this is something that I've said to lefties. The CIA is six dudes with a briefcase of a few million bucks and a few machine guns. That's who they are. And so if you're in a fucked up country and they show up and they, like, you know, support a coup or something like that, your country was already fucked up to begin with. They're capitalizing on the fucked upness to the United States' benefit.
Yeah.
And so for you, like you're saying, the CIA can topple anybody. I don't think they can topple anybody. King Kim Jong-un or the Un dynasty, they've been a thorn in America's side for almost 70 years. If you look at the, you know, Russia with Putin for the past like 20 or 30 years, we've tried to had tried to have like a political rapprochement with them a few times. And Russia's kind of said, we'll come your way, but we want to do our own thing. And that's not good enough for us. So we keep pushing them into the corner, pushing them into the corner until Ukraine. And so, yeah, so I think it's both. But I think that if you were to say like, hey, individual CIA case officer, why haven't you snitched on all the fucked up shit you're doing? They're probably going to say, because I actually believe in the project of American empire.
I totally agree with that aspect. Yes. But so I think that these like Kim Jong-un you brought up, these people are just they if they wanted to, if there was an actual threat, they would remove them. But what you need to have a boogeyman so we can continue saying, oh, we need to, this is why we still have to spend, you know, what is it? 30, how much do we spend on military or whatever that insane?
It's like $700 billion, but we have like another $500 billion in discretionary spending. So it's like 1.2, 1.5.
That's trillion. Like, that's my mind. They do this because they need somebody to say, oh, you know, he could attack you in your sleep. We got to defend ourselves, but you don't, yeah. you more in the camp that they're actual adversaries.
Oh yeah. I agree with their assessment. And also, like, so for instance, like, I know that $1.5 trillion, I mean, it's literally like a quarter or a third of American annual tax revenue. So I agree with you, but I don't view the United States as solely protecting American interest. I think that if you looked at it, it's obvious that we're not.
Agreed.
We're protecting European interests. We're protecting our allies' interests. We're protecting the $65 trillion global commercial hegemony that we exist. So actually, if you say, like, do the math on that, $65 trillion divided by 1.5, and then even add in all the paltry budgets of our allies, let's add like another, you know, $3 trillion, or let's say it's like $3 or $4 trillion. You have, we're talking about security. And from like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is a concept, if you're unfamiliar with, I invite you to familiarize yourself with it. But the second tier is security. So basically, like, it's a psychological concept. I misuse it all the time. But from my perspective, it says why you do what you do when you do it. And so there's five tiers, and it's kind of like a pyramid. And it's physical needs, security needs, social needs, ego needs, self-actualization. And so for me, if I was to take this psychological concept and apply it to global affairs, you're talking about a budget of $3 trillion on an annual basis between the United States and its allies. And you're talking about $65 trillion of economic activity on the scale of things. While the United States taxpayer is the person who's getting, you know, ramrodded in this deal, they're also the primary beneficiaries of the $65 trillion economic activity because we have all the consumer products right. that we have in our households.
Right.
So it's not just a one-way fucking. It's actually like a relatively okay deal. But who do you want to tell? This is the thing that frustrates me. If you told 19-year-olds, hey, you're not fighting for cherry pie and Susie J. Rottencrotch and fucking strip clubs and Southern rock and roll. You're not fighting for that. You're fighting for a $65 trillion global empire. Mm-hmm. Who wants to die for that empire? And the answer is not a lot of people, because symbolically it's not, who cares? It's going to be there regardless of whether or not I join or die. And for me, that's the most nefarious part of it, is the lie. That's the, if we were just honest about what we were doing, I would view it as less nefarious. But for me, lying to 19-year-old kids so they go die in a foreign war to perpetuate a $65 trillion commercial empire so you can make Funko Pops. and they think that they're fighting for fucking Southern rock and roll, whiskey, and fucking strip clubs. Yeah. That, to me, is fucking gross.
Well, so do you, where do you see, because like I'm a big anti-globalist. I think most people in the conspiracy world are, you know, there's a few phrases we use to refer to globalism. And it seems America, and obviously technology helped this, but all of our actions are not, very rarely are they set for America first. And I'm not trying to steal a Groyper term, but you know.
No, it's true.
That, and so I feel like that adds to my conspiracy fuel, is that all these decisions that are made by our politicians and people that are supposed to have our back and these these billionaires, none of them have ever gone to America. And that's why I think I fall in this conspiracy camp, because I just refuse to believe that any, I think that everything they do is actually against our best interest or Americans' best interest.
Yeah. So I don't think it is. And I think that studying history can be like revelatory in this respect, where we get narrativized this like uber libertarian, individualist, Republican, liberal narrative of American history, but it's not true. So human rights are important. I'm very grateful for the Constitution. I'm very grateful for my right to free speech and Second Amendment and Fourth Amendment and all that kind of stuff. But this is not what America really is. What America really is 13 colonies that were sick of paying taxes to a global empire across the pond. So we told them to eat a dick and we won. And then after that, we said, hey, there's a shitload of land that not very many people are using right now. Let's conquer it, despite the fact that there's people there. And we did. And then Mexico, we asked to buy California and New Mexico and Arizona, and Mexico told us to go fuck ourselves, even though they only had 2,000 settlers in right. the province of California. And they told us to fuck ourselves one too many times. And we said, oops, just kidding. Battle of the Alamo, that's our trigger to fucking take all this land. Oops, we took all your land. Go fuck yourself. And so if you look at this too, like, we originally tried a pacifistic and isolationist approach to international commerce in the 19th century. We sent relatively unarmed American merchant ships into the Mediterranean, and they were captured and killed by Barbary pirates, literally Ottoman sponsored pirates in the Mediterranean. And then we had the Barbary Pirate Wars, where Marines and American military went into the Mediterranean in order to fight Muslim pirates. And then, same thing with the banana wars in the 19th century with, basically like there were Central and South American countries that were like, hey, we don't want to sell to you, America, eat a dick. And we're like, oh, really? Fuck me. Fuck you. And that's, that's kind of, but if you look at that, there's incremental commercial interest first, then there's pushback and conflict against the commercial interest. Then there's American commitment, like hesitancy to commit to conflict. And then I would say after World War II, the damage from World War II was so significant that we said that it's better to have a power stalemate in which less people die, but global commerce thrives, than it is to be morally isolationist and then be sucked into conflict later. And while it was never put up to the American population for a vote, I do think that if you look at our military and diplomatic posture since World War II, that's what makes sense. It's kind of like an unstated world police role to prevent World War III. That's where we've been at since World War II.
It's an interesting viewpoint, dude. That's like totally, so you brought up, I think the banana wars, you're taught like the United Fruit Company. Is that what you were like? And so that event, this is my take from it. This, I forget the guy's name. It was Guatemala, right?
Yeah, and Smedley Butler was a Marine who wrote about it, and his book is War's a Racket.
Yeah, I've definitely heard that name. But So in my mind there, that whoever took power in Guatemala, he wanted to give his people a better life because we were slave, American corporations were using slave labor. Great. What's that?
Oh, it wasn't great.
Yeah. No, it was horrible. And then, once he stood up, the CIA, which is the these corporations, private militia, goes in there, overthrows a coup. 2 million Guatemalans are slaughtered, and so this, my view is that this has the American government, aspects of its total and complete backing, and that's how I approach like all of these things, is like it's a purposeful, calculated move. But you come from like a different side of this.
Well, I think it's the racial tribalism and indifference to the slaughter of other people probably has evolved in the past 150 years. I think that in the 19th century, if 2 million Guatemalans kill each other, I think the attitude at the time was like, who gives a fuck? They're Guatemalans. Nowadays, I think we have like a more empathetic and understanding worldview where, so for instance, like in the war on terror with Afghanistan, we actually tried to implement democracy. We tried to give them democratic institutions and schools and all that kind of stuff. And you could say that was just a psyop to justify our presence there. But I think there were real people on the ground, Afghan and American, who wanted to make it work. They wanted, you know, education for girls. They wanted to have better infrastructure for the Afghan government and economy to thrive. And what happened was it just didn't work. You can't impose this stuff by fiat. People have to meet you halfway, and they have to want to do it themselves. So, but then weirdly, instinctively, this might make the CIA worse, where they're like, oh, well, we tried to give you billions of dollars in order to improve your society, and you told us to fuck off. Well, we'll just go back to killing people, you know, and if millions of people die, that's kind of on you, not on us. And I think we even see that in Afghanistan now, where I think they're in a famine. And I think that they're in a relative civil war with the Taliban in power. And I don't think we're going to do shit, because we're basically going to say, we gave you a few billion bucks and 20 years of security assistance. You didn't do shit with it. Fuck you. And I think that's going to be the attitude.
Well, oh, sorry. Are you continuing?
No.
Okay. Well, you seem to know Middle East very well, but there was this time, I can't remember the year, but it was during like the 30s or 20s, 40s, maybe in the 50s. It was the 50s because CIA just started, but they had a king who was a tyrant in Afghanistan. What's that?
Oh, if it's Afghanistan, it's different. Sorry, I was guessing. Oh, okay.
But so what they did though, this king, he was, you know, selling to American corporations. He was worth so many. He gets chased out of his own country, hides in Italy, and meets Alan Dulles. And the guy that they elected or whatever, he was a nationalist trying to, you know, nationalize the oil so everyone could. And then the CIA comes in and they get him killed, right? They overthrow a coup. So yeah. I know I'm like stuck on this point, but I just struggle to believe. I'm sure there are some people there that think they're like helping and bringing democracy, but I think there's just so many patterns or examples that never was that wasn't what happened or wasn't the case.
Oh, I think I agree with you. So if you're thinking of Iran in particular, there was I think it was Mossadegh. He was a socialist nationalist in Iran who wanted to nationalize the oil company. And Britain basically said, like, no, we have a monopoly on your oil. Fuck you. Maybe, and yeah. Mossadegh said, fuck you back. And so the United States, if I remember correctly, they helped the British in a coup to impose the Shah of Iran. And the Shah, in many respects, was Western friendly and progressive. Mm-hmm. He banned the burqa and, basically wanted a bunch of like progressive educational reforms and progressive social reforms. But that his progressive social reforms combined with his authoritarian style, where he literally just tortured people for 20 or 30 years in order to remain in power. And we looked the other way because we had a monopoly on Iranian oil. That fomented the issues in Iran, where we ultimately had the revolution that installed the Ayatollah. Because what ended up happening was, if I remember, there were democracy protests. The Shah cracked down on the democracy protests with the blessing of the Western world. The theocrats said, hey, listen, the only thing that beats fire is fire, and we got plenty of fire. Give us the power. And then what happened is all these pro-democracy people basically got subsumed into the theocratic movement. The theocrats chase the Shah of Iran out of the country. And now we have a hostile regime that doesn't want anything to do with the West, because if you look at the most recent century, our entire history in Iran is give us oil and we don't care how bad you torture your people.
Right.
And that's often our position is keep the material goods flowing, and we don't care what happens to the people inside your country.
Yeah, absolutely agreed. Yeah. No, dude, you're very articulate, man. I'm super impressed. So I want to say, so let's jump to, we're going to get off of the conspiracy history, and obviously school shootings are happening at an insane rate. And you're an ex-police officer. I mean, you have a total new insight than my opinion. So what is your take on all of this? Like, do you have to change gun regulations, or what do you have to do to maintain a semblance of calmness and peacefulness?
I don't, I think any gun control that would actually do anything would be European style gun control. And I think that has a snowball's chance in hell of passing in the United States. I think even I would be opposed to it. And actually I'm just opposed to it. I don't like it. And the reason why is because we have an ingrained culture inside the United States, which basically says, you know, it's better to have an armed civilian population that is capable of toppling its own government than it is to have a disarmed population that then has to learn the hard way about governmental oppression. And if you look at the past, I don't know, hour of our conversation, you can see why the government shouldn't be the only people who have firearms, right? Like they do evil, nefarious shit all the time in the name of the greater good. So we don't trust people like that. So I believe in the diffusion of power. I believe in civilian right to keep and bear arms. I believe in the Second Amendment. I believe in the Republic. The problem, though, is even if we instituted California style gun control, where we have like Glocks with, you know, 10 round magazines and no assault weapons and all that kind of stuff, one, we have so many in circulation, I don't think it matters. And then two, basically, this doesn't really change anything. The Virginia Tech shooter was able to kill 32 people with a 9mm pistol and a 22 pistol. And really, the main variables that seem to drive the casualty count in these events is police response time and soft targets. That seems to be the main thing. So if you have 30 to 50 or 30 to a few thousand unarmed people gathered in a central location, nobody has a gun, nobody has the ability to respond, law enforcement is slow on the uptick, you can basically create mass mayhem very quickly. And so for me, specifically with schools, this is still going to leave other soft targets. Grocery stores are soft targets, stadiums are soft targets, entry points to stadiums and music events and all that kind of stuff, those are soft targets. Downtown areas are soft targets. Anybody can really find a gun or a car and cause a mass casualty event very quickly. But if you wanted to eliminate schools from this, you would have to do some of the steps that Florida did. So for instance, we have one school resource officer per 1,000 students. We have one school resource officer mandatory in every single school. We a majority of the schools are looking at security measures. They're woefully inadequate. But I think like single point and like having surge amounts of law enforcement officers during entry and exit times, where you have like three or four officers on campus when everybody's come to school and leaving school, and having single point entry during the school day, where literally you have to go in one way and leave one way, that goes by a school resource officer during the school day. I think that could not completely eliminate school shootings, but significantly reduce the ones where the people literally walk on campus. And then the only ones that you still have to deal with are the ones where a kid sticks a pistol in his backpack and everybody freezes when he pulls the gun. That's the remaining school shooting that will still occur. And I think we have to train people, run, hide, fight, and know how to render medical. Like this should be basic skill.
Do you think, so I think I heard a statistic, it was something like in Mexico, they've had like, you know, 30 school shootings while America's had 300 in the year or some, it's something absurd. Like that makes no sense for a place that's, you know, much more dangerous, more crime or whatever. So why is it in America? So this is why I think it's a conspiracy, but why in America is there just, are we blowing, is it, are we all just insane in America? Like what are we doing here?
I think our violence all together is actually very low. I think that we're at Europe, generally speaking, is between 2 to 3 homicides per 100,000. America is at 5 per 100,000. So we're talking about double European. But if you look at like Mexico, I want to say Mexico is at like 22 per 100,000. Like Guatemala, Nicaragua, I want to say some of those countries are at like 50 per 100,000. So just fucking insane numbers, like literally wartime numbers.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the crazy things was, I think it was 2007 or 2008, actually, when I was deployed to Iraq, there were more homicides in Mexico per capita than there were in Iraq per capita. And like, we just ignore that. We just brush it off. And so for me, American violence is a little bit different because I feel like we bottle and bottle and bottle and bottle, and we kind of have like a sick society, and we don't take care of our people, and we don't take care of the mentally ill, and we don't take care of our communities, and we don't have health care, and it's kind of a dog eat dog society. So when people fall through the nets and then they eventually freak out and kill people, it's fucking bad. But I think that it's an inevitability when you kind of have this Darwinian society with lots of access to firearms. And you kind of got to pick your poison. Do you want the safe, soft tyranny of Japan and Western Europe? do you want the absolute anarchy of Somalia or Mexico or, you know, Central America? Or do you want this like mixed free or at least liberty based world in the United States, where the statistical probability of you being involved in a mass shooting event are like one in a million, one in a few million, but it's still there and it's still real. And so you got to pick your poison.
No, I like that. So you left the Libertarian Party. What was your, because I think that's a funny trajectory, like at least in the conspiracy world, I know you're not, but you'll go from like, you know, Trump, 2016 Trump, you fall into anarchy or libertarianism. And now I don't know where the hell I am, but what made you leave the Libertarian Party?
The dynamics of power. That's what made me leave. So libertarians, what is it? It's like we have a stated goal to take over the world and then leave you alone. Right. Like that's like the quote, the problem is libertarians want to collect power in order to eliminate their own power. And that's not something that a lot of people want. A lot of people want, they want security. They want cops, they want firefighters, they want EMTs. They want this to be state subsidized so it's free to them at the point of service. They want quality healthcare. They want a secure military. They want secure borders. They want, you know, basically to know that Uncle Sam will come and hug them and give them a cup of cocoa and a fucking like an aluminum blanket after there's a house fire. You know, they want insurance companies to be forced to charge reasonable rates so they have the ability to get insurance. So a lot of people, including myself, we all resent the social institutions that impose themselves upon us. But I think when it really comes down to it, people are, they're not looking for raw liberty or raw security. They're looking for a balance between the two. Mm-hmm. And I think statism, as much as it's committed many heinous crimes in its history, I think statism is going to exist, and the chances of creating an anarchist or libertarian society are very low.
What do they call it? Ancapistan, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And have you seen the meme of Ancapistan where it's literally just like theocrats like beheading everybody and fucking taking over because like the libertarian, because there's actually a great fascist meme where it's like, hey, we're stronger as individuals. And they're in like a Spartan shield wall. Yeah. And it's like, everybody fight by yourself. And like, that's kind of like, you know, like it's a little bit memey, but I believed it. Like,
no.
Like you're stronger with a community.
Yeah. Right. Well, and I always pose this question to these, like the anarchists and libertarians, is what's to stop somebody else, like a Jeff Bezos, from having his own military? I mean, how would you be able to stop this? You know, like there's just
private
so many-
military. McNukes.
Yeah. Nukes. No, but seriously though, right? Like there are some truly evil people out there that are so power hungry. They will do whatever they need to keep that power. I don't know. That's fine.
Well, and the truth is this is why, I still revere the founding fathers, is because they looked at all the governments of the world. They looked at, you know, Greece with pure democracy. They looked at Rome with the Republic. They looked at, you know, tyrannies and dictatorships and all that kind of stuff. And they said, what about these work and what about these don't work? And one of the conclusions they came to is balance of power, like balance of power always and first. And that's what, as inefficient as their system is, I do like that the factions are so busy squabbling over the minute amounts of power that they can accrue, that no one of them has been able to take over. And so that's where I actually feel like the system is working in some respects.
That was going to be so I want to get your take on this, but this is where I'm at right now, and you can smash it down. So the Freemasons have been behind every revolution through Europe, you know, the French Revolution, all these times, and they'll openly admit that in their whatever books or minutes or whatever you want to call it. So I started getting this belief that they would overthrow these monarchies to install a republic or a
constitutional republic.
Yeah. And they do this because that is the most easy system to corrupt, because you just need to buy off politicians and buy off votes. So now that's like brought me to this like weird stage where sometimes I think like, I'm just searching, but is a monarchy the best form of government? Is that the, why else would they?
No, because then they're going to get, in the ear of the king, man. Like there's only one key holder of power. Agreed. And also like, I would, I would ask, like, so if the Freemasons claimed every power play in history, I would view that as like propaganda. Like, almost nobody is in charge of everything at all right. times. Okay.
Right.
So, you know, so maybe the Freemasons got one, maybe the lizard people got another one, maybe the Jews got another one, maybe, you know, different people, maybe the American statist hegemonics like me, maybe they got one conspiracy done, but no one person has been responsible for every single conspiracy.
Oh, I totally agree with that.
Yeah. So where does that put us? You know, what's the solution against this manipulation of power? I would be curious, in the Freemasons' own literature, do they view it as like, oh, we want a democratic republic because it's easy to corrupt public officials in order to get what we want? Or would they say, we want a democratic republic because the balance of power within this thing is the best place that we can thrive and flex our own power, but also other competing political institutions are able to as well. And we view that as a moral good. Cause I don't think most organizations have like internally nefarious propaganda. I think they all, you know, justify their worldview as good and everybody else as an ignorant rube.
Yeah. So do you think how do we fix this system that's clearly, I think it's beyond broken. Like, I mean, simple things as just people getting by, it's getting harder and harder. And we send $50 billion to Ukraine. Like, how do you fix this system?
Communitarianism. Individualism, I view as a failed project. No man is an island. We don't all die alone. We're not born alone. We have a lot of impact on each other's lives. Even this conversation, I'm hoping to have had some impact on, like, given you and your audience some things to think about. So
you definitely have. Not
excellent. So so community, and then collectivism is also bad because you have to subsume your individual will to a project not of your design. Whereas communitarianism, I would view as the struggle between the individual and the collective, and I would view it as the focus on the community. What we have to do is say, what skills do I have? What do, like, a personal inventory of what do I have to offer the world, and then offer it to the world. And then not only that, like, after our material needs are met, once the bills are paid, you've eaten for the day, your family might have a retirement, all that kind of stuff, take 1% to 10% of your energy or your finances and redirect it back to the community, not through taxes, but through the what you think is wrong with the world. And I think that you would find that you will improve. And I think you will find that your community improves. And if we could get enough people to buy into that communitarian mindset, we might actually see a better world. So, yeah.
Well, so, and you know, we've never been this politically divided. I think like the Civil War,
1865.
Maybe, but we're almost at like just a no killing war. But people would, if you said go for it, they would. You know, as you know, people would jump on that. We see that on Twitter all the time. But what, like, how do you even, you, if there, this is such a big gap, how do you even? And you're kind of in the middle. I don't know where I am, but people that are, you know, a Fox and a CNN, they can't see eye to eye on a single thing.
Yeah. So I think communitarianism is the path forward. And then also I think that basically, like, we have to start here. So we're at in the 1970s, there were three major media companies that controlled all of the American narrative. So you think that there's like groupthink and mind control now? Oh my God. Like, wait, prior to, sorry, go ahead.
Well, you're saying there's three in the, cause the Telecommunications Act was in like 96, and that even cut it down even more. But you think in the 70s it was less, or
yeah,
less companies?
Yeah. Cause there was literally just three channels. There was, like, you know, CBS, ABC and something else, and that was it. You literally turned on your TV, you had three channels, and they all had competing news segments that were all telling you the same thing, and they were all telling you that Vietnam was based in Red Pilled. I'm joking there, obviously. Yeah. During the Vietnam, yes, there was plenty of counteraction to the war, but the point being that, like, you're saying that it's limited to three companies, but Up until the 1990s, when we started having cable television, we went from having three channels to a few thousand. And then with the internet, we went from a few thousand to a few billion. We're now in an attention economy where somebody like me, who has a 10-year-old DSLR camera, a $150 ring light that my mother-in-law gave me, and the ability to download a free software program, I have 70 people watching us right now. Mm-hmm. I probably, after the conversation is posted, we will have a few thousand people check out this conversation. And so, and this is only 2 years of effort. Right. And I'm in competition with other factional leaders who want to propagandize and push in their own narrative. So you were kind of asking me, like, where do we go from here?
Yeah.
I think we have to fight between the extreme left and the extreme right. I think we have to resolve our differences. And I am of the Burkean conservative position of what do we have that works that we must hold on to? And if somebody tells them to change it, we will literally shoot them because that's how important it is. And what do we have that's not important that we can let go on in order to come together as a society? And if we start operating from that like inventory basis, I think we can bridge these gaps.
Mm. I like it, dude. At last, I heard this like quote, and maybe you can or somebody said this, that politics for most of like history has been like an elite group, like the people that are very well off, they're the ones that are interested in politics. And the only time people get involved and start paying attention is when everything has gone to shit. Do you agree with that statement?
Oh, literally 2/3 of people are still ambivalent about politics, despite the entire country going to the fucking hell in a handbasket. Yeah.
100%. I just found that.
We're dorks. We're fucking dorks with niche interests, but there's a bunch of other dorks out there who want to hear what we have to talk about.
Yeah. No, I just found that it was an interest. I didn't know if you you agreed with that statement or not, but
100%. Yeah. We are a niche community. We could probably be infinitely richer if we were talking about the Amber Heard trial or some shit.
This is true, dude. Well, this is so perfect, man. Where can everyone find you? I know my listeners, you're definitely viewpoints that were way different than what they're used to hearing, and myself. So where can they find you and all those good things?
Yeah, so the easiest thing to do is type in Counterpoints into YouTube. We just broke 23.7K, something like that, trying to break 25. I want to break 100K by 2024. That's my goal. And then basically the content that I have to offer you, it's kind of a hodgepodge and a mix. We're trying to increase our quality right now. But if you want to see me yell at internet leftists, that is a good chunk of my content is debate content. If you want to see violence or science fiction, I do break down like movie series such as like Fury, End of Watch, Full Metal Jacket from a military veteran's perspective. And then if you're a science fiction nerd specifically, I am a massive, massive Warhammer 40,000 nerd, like huge. So I break down all of the animated series that have come out in that universe. And if you're into 8-foot tall, genetically engineered space racists in power armor, then you should check out the Warhammer 40,000 playlist because you'll very much enjoy it. And yeah, just type in Counterpoints Common Spelling into Twitch or YouTube. You'll find me.
Love. And Red Rising? That reminds me of this Warhammer. Did you see that book? It's like I think it's relatively newer. Have you ever read it?
If it's Horus Rising, that's one of my favorite books. If it's a different book,
it's called, I think, Red Rise. I think they're making a movie out of it, but it sounded like what you were just talking about. So if you're into science fiction,
if you're into 8-foot tall, genetically engineered space,
that's what this has, dude. Yeah. Well, so I'll put all your links in the show notes, dude. And thank you. Really, I learned a lot. You're a real articulate guy. So I love this. So thank you, dude. And we'll talk again soon.
My very sincere pleasure. Let's do it again.
All right, Connor. Take care, buddy.
Catch you.